Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Consequence Podcast Network.
My friendship to all of you precludes my involvement with any one of you. But if you want to make love, then I do too, and I'll be right there behind you. All in the name of oath. All in the name of oath. All in the name of oath.
Greetings, constant listeners, and welcome yet again to the Losers Club, a Stephen King podcast. It's been a while. We're back, baby.
Yeah. I'm 2 months.
Yeah, it's been about, has it been 2 months? Yeah, late November.
Yeah, yeah. The last time we were Dr. Duerme.
Wait, what?
Dr. Sleep. I was using, I don't know why.
I'm rocking Randall Colburn, and who are you?
Michael Myers Rothman, and that's only just because I couldn't think of a Kingian middle nickname.
Well, we've been gone for 2 months. We're a little rusty. Yeah. That's okay. We have a special guest, but first, we just want to say thank you for bearing with us.
Yeah.
Over these last 2 months, we've been doing some reconstructing. We're figuring out a few things about the future of the pod, and also the holidays. Oh boy, they were just hell.
Holidays were hell, and I don't think any of the holidays last year were orthodox in any shape or form. I mean, here, at least in Chicago, Halloween, snowstorm.
Yep.
Thanksgiving, it felt like a weird spring dew day.
Mm-hmm.
Christmas was warmer than most of the summer days.
Not much holiday spirit.
And then New Year's was just an ice storm, and not the Ang Lee variety. So
it's true,
because that actually takes place on Thanksgiving. So it really confused us.
So we're kicking off the new year. Just to give you an idea of what the next few weeks are going to look like, we're kicking off with a review of The Outsider, which is on HBO, adapted from the Stephen King book from 2018. Man, they turned that around fast.
That might be the fastest turnaround for a Stephen King
adaptation. Every time I was writing it up, I was like, wait, it came out in 2017, right? Mm-hmm. No, it's 2018. Yeah. And so, so we're going to be talking about that. And then we're also going to cap it off with a little addendum about Castle Rock, the ending of Castle Rock. Our episode on the first 5 episodes was one of our more beloved episodes.
Oh,
I'd
yeah,
say.
Absolutely. Everyone
just kidding.
Loved it.
You guys were really mad about that. Which
we still get messages from it.
But hey, guess what? We were right.
Yeah, we were right.
Because it sucked.
Yeah.
So that's tune in for those thoughts later.
We're actually going to have Tim Robbins on the show, and he's going to give us a whole, he's going to be absolutely transparent about, I just thought it was a really bad season. That's my Tim Robbins impersonation, by the way.
And then, so we're going to be discussing those. We'll be back again next week to talk about the King in 2020, what the future, kind of just, you know, prepare us for the future sort of episode. And then
fun soon fact, no King movies this year.
Yeah,
none
that are, well, they're
unless
in development.
Press Stop comes
well, like,
out.
I feel like something will come out. We just don't know about it yet.
Yeah.
Like, because there's been so many that have been announced.
What if Mike Flynn? Oh, well. Director's cut of Dr. Sleep. Maybe we'll be talking about that a little bit.
Yeah,
too.
We might talk about that.
Hopefully get it.
Yeah, yeah. And so we'll be doing that. And then we're going to our first book of the year, which we've been hyping on social media, and we hyped, you know, at the end of last year. Needful Things.
Yes.
This is a big one.
It's a huge one.
And I adore this novel.
This is shorter than it, though.
What was that?
This is shorter than it.
It's like, I think it's like 750, 800 around there.
Yeah.
And I'm very, very excited to talk about this book. I feel like I've been dropping references to it since day one.
Yeah.
And we're really excited about that. So we're going to be, I would say early February, probably expect.
Yeah, early
episodes.
February, right in time for Valentine's Day. And who's your Valentine? I would say Ace Merrill.
Ace Merrill is absolutely my Valentine.
Ace in the hole.
Let's just say Bauer Hour is coming back.
Yep.
And this time it's going to be about Ace.
Yeah.
So I cannot wait. It's going to be fun. So if you have not started your reread of Needful Things or your first read of Needful Things, you better get on it, because although it reads quick.
It does really read quick. I think, you know, it starts off, you're in, and then there's a little lull, and then something explosive happens.
Oh,
and
man.
You're just...
And then that last half of that book is just, it's ravenous. It's as rabid as Cujo.
Ooh.
Reference.
Up there on the Camber Ranch.
Yes, it's true. So that's the future right now. And we have a few other announcements that we're going to make in the coming month or two. We're still figuring some things out. So lots to look forward to, including having a guest on this episode.
Oh, yes. In fact, we just talked about Needful Things. She has read Needful Things 5 times, which I think might beat any of us on the podcast.
I'm 3, so.
You're 3?
Yeah.
What's the most Stephen King books that you've read?
Like the most
times.
I've read one book.
Yeah.
Probably The Stand.
That's what I thought.
I read 4 times.
4 times.
Yeah. So
that's no slouch of a book either. So.
I know. Well, it's my first King and I revisited it often. So although Needful Things, I read 3, and then Tommyknockers, I read 4.
Oh God.
Including the reread, which is why I think I was highly qualified to be the defender.
Yeah.
The lone defender.
So. I think so.
So, Jen, why don't you introduce yourself? Who are you and why are you here?
Hi, I am Jen Holly Gibney Adams, and
nice,
good one,
nice.
And I am just a huge Stephen King fan. I think I might have you beat on the number of times that I've read The Stand, though.
Oh shit!
I know, I lost count around like 8.
Wow.
So here's what happened. Before I discovered that podcasts existed, I just used to listen to Stephen King audiobooks over and over again. So I think I've actually physically read Needful Things 2 times, but I've listened to it probably about 3, maybe 4 times.
Oh, wow.
Who narrates that audiobook, the Needful Things one?
Stephen King.
Oh, he does
it? Oh, wow.
He does. Yeah, it's a really good audio because you hear it in his voice, like, you've been here before.
My God.
Well, that's actually interesting because when I've been reading it, there is... that authorial presence is very present in this book. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I want to talk about on the episode, but because there's a lot of like, you know, there's that omniscience to it, mm-hmm. to the narration. And
he pivots depending on what character he's discussing.
It's kind of jarring sometimes, but mm-hmm. I kind of like it too. So, and then Jen, you are the host of another podcast on the Consequence Podcast Network. What is it?
I am. Yeah, I am one of the co-hosts of the Horror Virgin podcast. We are a comedy horror podcast. My friend Todd is the horror virgin and he does not like horror because he's terrified of it. So every week we kind of make him watch a movie and then we just talk about it after. I try to convince him that horror is the greatest and that he should love it. And then we kind of laugh at how scared he gets a little bit. But yeah, it's really fun. And we just joined the Consequence of Sound Network. So we're really excited about that.
Sweet. Yeah, and I've been totally excited because I've been a huge fan and I've been going through your entire catalog. And to keep it King, I actually was listening to The Mist. And I really loved hearing how Todd... Despite the fact that his entire crew, because he was working on a film set at the time uh-huh. when The Mist was released, his entire crew having a fun time drinking, they're all like, let's go see a movie. And Todd is so scared of horror movies that he's like, nah, I'm going to go home. Like, the entire crew is going out to go see this movie. That sounds like a heavenly night for me. And he's like, no, I'm going to go home. I'm good.
I'll always remember The Mist getting ruined for me when I saw it in the theaters because there was two bad boys sitting in front of us and they were just giggling and laughing the whole time. And it was like, and on their phones, it was the absolute worst. It was ruined the whole experience.
You almost wish that they were in the car at the end.
I wish they were.
Oh, God, Jesus. All right. We don't need to go down that, especially in this day and age. But I actually saw it with Caffrey and I want to say Caffrey was fatigued by the ending.
Yeah.
Because he had read it.
Yeah, we've talked because I hated the ending too at first.
Yeah,
I've come around to it.
There's a lot of insight in the episodes. So you should, you know, it's actually a really good entry point, I feel, to the Horror Virgin. And I think, you know, if constant listeners, constant readers, if you want to start there, go for it. But you've covered a couple other King works too. So
We did Carrie and then we've done both It chapters 1 and 2. We did Misery and then we did The Shining pretty recently, and that's I think that's one of our better episodes. We kind of got pretty deep in discussing some of the themes of the book, but it's still pretty funny in places too. So yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, and I mean that's actually a pretty high grade horror movie for Todd to be watching. I would imagine
it is,
too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, he had to work up to it.
Yeah. Which is hilarious. Yeah, because one of the other ones I listened to is Tremors, which was probably the most like outrageous episode I've listened to so far because there's nothing really scary about Tremors per se. Like there's some moments, but anyway, yeah, Tremors has been in my mind for like the past 48 hours.
Well, yeah, you just reposted our piece that I had totally forgotten.
Me
wrote
too. too. And yeah. Blake actually, who was, you know, Blake Goble on the site, he like had suggested, like, well, hey, the 30th anniversary, why don't you just repost this?
Yeah.
And oddly enough, like, the only thing I had to edit was the fact that, like, instead of the fifth movie coming out soon, oh no, the sixth movie, the seventh movie had already come out.
Oh,
so
wow.
Like, that's how many have already come out since then. But
yeah, it was funny because I was reading it and I was like, oh yeah. Like, my whole Tremors scared the fucking hell out of me. I didn't see it as a comedy when I was a kid.
Yeah, and me either. Like, honestly, like, when the couple are in that station wagon as a kid,
it's terrifying.
Yeah.
It's so scary. Speaking of scary, The Outsider's kind of scary. Let's talk about that.
Terrence Maitland, I'm arresting you for the murder of Frankie Peterson.
For the what?
I'm as baffled by this conflicting evidence as you are. His prints are all over the crime scene. The TV footage puts him 60 miles away.
He can't have been in two places at once. You know me.
I didn't kill that kid, Ralph.
Do you see how strange this is?
What would make someone do such a thing?
He didn't do it.
I have no tolerance for the unexplainable.
Well then, sir, you'll have no tolerance for me. Answer me this. Do you think Terry Maitland killed that boy?
If he didn't do it, someone else did. Someone else did. Someone else did.
I didn't kill that boy, Ralph.
Oh man.
I've been saying that quote. So look, HBO has been going gung-ho with promoting the show, and for all the right reasons.
Yeah.
And I had not seen Watchmen, which is the other you know, big epic series that they, you know, they had for in the fall. And so I binge watched that a couple weeks ago, but before every fucking episode, there was the trailer for The Outsider. Unfortunately, I'd already seen like the six episodes from the screeners for it, so nothing was really spoiled by seeing the trailer again and again and again. But that one line of Jason Bateman just being like, didn't kill that boy, Ralph, or didn't kill that kid, Ralph. Like, I have literally said that line at least like 100 times in the house, just at random intervals, because it's just the way that Bateman has that cadence. It just sticks with me, and it just, it's so, and I've seen that on Reddit. People have been putting it like randomly in like the Outsider subreddits.
Oh my God,
which
really?
Is really funny. Yeah.
That's fun.
But yeah.
Well, let's talk about, let's intro, like, I guess, like, what is our individual experiences with The Outsider? So, Mike, why don't you start? Like, had you read the book before you watched the series?
So, The Outsider is one of the first books that we actually received an advance copy for doing the podcast.
That was exciting.
And it was very exciting. And I was actually planning on reading it. But something happened that summer. So it was 2018. So that it was probably the film festival. And I was like, no, my hands are tied. And I didn't read it.
Yeah.
And
Mel and I were the ones who read it for the pod. Yeah.
And I believe it was either you or Mel that said it would work better as a TV show.
Mel said that. Yeah. Which and is, she was right.
She, yeah.
Well, spoiler alert. But I guess. But so you hadn't read it, and then you.
I've not read it,
so
no.
Basically, Mike and I have watched the first six episodes of The Outsider. We won't spoil anything. We're just going to talk about the first three episodes and maybe hint at what's to come. And Jen, how many have you seen?
I've seen the first three.
Okay, cool. And what was your experience with the book? Have you read the book?
I have read the book, yeah. When it came out, I got it, but I have been working on a chronological reread for about like 7 years, and I was so close in the timeline that I just waited until I got to it, and so I ended up finishing it a couple of months ago.
Nice.
Oh, just in time for the show.
So were you excited for the series based on your read?
I was really excited. I loved the first half of the book, and I really liked the second half.
Yeah. I think that sums up a lot of Mel and I's thoughts too. It takes kind of a hard right turn because
that's what I was going to say.
Yeah, I think we're not going to spoil the ending of The Outsider, so don't worry about that. But
no, please don't. Yeah.
Yeah, because you don't even
know
it.
Like, yeah. My girlfriend's reading right now. She's like, I'm going to get to the ending before this show's over, and I'm like, no.
Nice. So I think it's interesting to consider that like the people who are making this. So, and also the history of the book a little bit, I guess, like, cause I was doing some research into, you know, King is a big true crime guy. Well, I keep saying true crime. It's not true crime. It's crime.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's just true crime.
But it falls in that realm.
I know. It's just become such a thing now, like the phrase true crime, because of all the podcasts and documentaries and everything.
And it's like, no surprise that he pivoted into that around the same time that he's doing that.
Well, too, I mean, you know? He wrote his first crime novel, which was The Colorado Kid in 2005.
Yeah.
And then he didn't write another. He's probably, I'm probably missing a few shorts here and there, like more crime focused ones. But then he wrote Joyland, I believe, in 2013. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of, you know, similar to Colorado Kid, very pulpy. It was even released on a book. What sort I'm looking for, like a publisher that specializes in pulpy books and stories. And and if you follow his Twitter account, you'll see he's always repping for crime authors. He loves like Don Winslow, guys like that. He is always repping for these guys. And you can tell that he's a little bit jealous, I think, of their ability to write that stuff. And so I think, you know, he's a malleable writer. That's one of the things that we've posited on this show a million times, is that, of course, obviously he's much more than just a horror writer. And so I think he's always wanting to try out these new forms. And so he's been trying out, you know, in small doses, these crime things. And then he did the Mr. Mercedes trilogy.
Yep.
And those, but then those weren't really hard boiled. They were more soft boiled. And then they kind of had a true crime, or what's the word I'm looking for? Like a supernatural element sort of interwoven.
So even the Mr. Mercedes trilogy does have supernatural tendencies?
Spoiler alert, yes.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I think most people know that by now.
Yeah.
It's the first book doesn't.
Yeah.
But later ones do.
So like End of Watch? Or?
Yeah, End of Watch mostly.
Okay.
And what's that, Jen?
I'm not sure if Finders Keepers does or not. I don't think the supernatural stuff really picks. There are hints of it in there, yeah.
Yeah, I think I think the hints come like right at the end, you know, because it's interesting. And so, I haven't watched the third season of Mr. Mercedes yet, but I believe that's because they did End of Watch second season. Because I think they had, you know, they can't just, because Brady is not a major character in Finders Keepers, the villain from the first season. So I think they couldn't have, what's his name?
Brandon Gleason.
Harry Treadaway.
Harry Treadaway. Yeah. I think they couldn't keep him around if he was just going to be in a hospital bed the whole time. So it's, it's interesting. But I've been enjoying Mr. Mercedes when I watch it. But yeah, so, you know, I think with Outsider, that was like when he really tried to channel hard-boiled crime, really forensic, investigative driven kind of stuff, you know, like procedural kind of crime. And
because the book is like written in like document form,
yes,
right?
It
like
begins
almost like a government
way.
Like
yeah,
you know, dossier.
It's written very much in like a formal style,
yeah.
In terms of using various official documents and transcripts to help get you in that mode, like
cool.
That you're poring over documents and case files and things like that. And then it really becomes a Stephen King book, you know, like, but that's not a bad thing. I think Outsiders got a lot to love, and Mel and I both liked it, I think, when we talked about it. But it is interesting. And so in that way, I think it's almost sort of a culmination of King's sort of, you know, I talked about this in my review for AV Club, is like his dalliance with true with crime writing is he kind of went full blown King as well as like full blown, like hard boiled. And that's, I think, what's fun about The Outsider, although it is jarring tonally, which I think is also going to be the challenge for the series, because I think the smart thing that they did, and, you know, considering the turnaround, it's amazing that they were able to secure this talent, which was Richard Price. Richard Price is the person, is the showrunner, and also has written, I think, almost every episode, if not every episode.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple episodes where it's credited to Dennis Lehane, actually.
Oh, nice.
Which is kind of crazy.
Well, there you go. And so Dennis Lehane also, and Richard Price, these are not just crime authors. These are like, you know, top of the line crime authors.
And I went through every single thing that Richard Price has written, and none of them involves the supernatural.
Right,
anyways,
I did that too.
Which
I was
wild.
I was very curious about that. Yeah. And so Richard Price, obviously, you probably know that name. He's been he wrote Clockers, which was a really famous novel, made into a very famous movie. He's written a great book called Lush Life that I would highly recommend. Just a beautiful novel about you know, the dreams. It's like art, dreams, crime, New York, all these things, and it's really good. And
so
then
I imagine most of his stuff is New York based, because he did like Sea of Love also with Al Pacino, and that's like a huge like hard boiled.
He also wrote Color of Money.
Yeah,
he's written a lot of, you know, really classic movies over the years. But then he pivoted to TV with The Wire.
Yeah.
Yeah. So David Simon brought him in the first season of The Wire, and Dennis Lehane also wrote on The Wire in later seasons. And because, I mean, that was sort of David Simon's genius with The Wire, was he only had, I think, one or two classic TV writers.
Yeah.
Because then he had journalists who wrote on the show. He had Ed Burns, his old collaborator, who was, you know, cop turned teacher turned writer. And then he also had all these crime authors like George Pelicanos. And then I'm probably saying his name wrong, or Pelicanos or
Pelicanos,
something.
Think,
and
yeah.
Incredible writer.
It wasn't even like a, wasn't like a Todd McCarthy like a part of, or, you know,
he acted in
acts
it.
In the scene.
Yeah. But he's,
and then he goes and does Spotlight.
Yeah. And then he went and did Spotlight. But then, you know, Dennis Lehane, Richard Price, and Richard Price was known. He kind of introduced Omar into like he was kind of the creator of Omar. And he would always write the episodes where Omar was introduced every season. That was kind of his trademark. And he also cameoed in the second season. He plays the guy who leads a book club in D'Angelo's prison. Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
I'm such a nerd. I've seen The Wire like 100 times.
In the second season is my favorite. So I totally remember that scene also.
And so, but then Richard Price went on, you know, obviously he took to it really well. And he worked on a couple other shows. I know he worked on most of David Simon shows. I'm pretty sure he wrote some Tremé episodes.
He wrote for The Deuce.
Mm-hmm. And then he also, kind of stepped into the showrunner role with The Night Of, which was what, 8 episodes?
It was about 8 episodes, 2015.
Yeah.
Really good. You know, proved a little polarizing at the end with some critics, even though I still thought it hit the landing really well. The thing that's so interesting about having this dichotomy of Richard Price, who's never written anything in the supernatural, with Stephen King, who has, is that they're both being challenged in ways that they've never really been in their lives. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, like King maybe less, you know, because he's obviously written like some true crime stuff and definitely written some nonfiction stuff. But what I get with this story particularly, and especially with this adaptation, is that like this might be the most challenging thing like Price has done, because there's such a delicate dance here.
Right. And that's what I really want to talk about.
Yeah.
But I think like Jen, were you familiar with Richard Price at all?
I was not. No, I was listening to everything you were saying. I was like, oh, wow.
Yeah. So Night Of was a story about, it was like about basically this guy who gets swept up in a murder trial and goes to prison.
I just watched The Night Of.
Oh, you did watch it. Nice.
Yeah. I just didn't realize it was him. But I was thinking Outsider feels a lot like The Night Of.
Yes.
And I have been referring to it as that. But yeah, and I really liked the ending of that. I kind of liked the ambiguity of it.
Mm-hmm. And that I was a huge fan of The Night Of, and I was thinking a lot about the ways that it does dovetail with The Outsider in terms of, like, obviously The Night Of has no, you know, horror elements to it, but
traditional horror elements.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But what I think is interesting is, you know, they're both about crimes that don't just impact, they're not crimes that exist within a vacuum. They're crimes that spread out. Like they have, like, one thing topples one thing topples one thing. And I think that's what, you know, obviously The Wire was a very big proponent of that, was, you know, all the pieces matter, which was kind of the, and I wrote that down in my notes for The Outsider, because it's the same thing. It's like, it's not just the murder.
No.
It's the ripple effect. Yeah, it's the ripple effect
of
the murder. And that to me is what Richard Price can capture so well. I remember one of the things I love in The Night Of was, I believe Riz Ahmed's character like drives his dad's car.
Yes.
And then
what happens to the dad?
Yeah. So then the dad can't access his car and he can't work.
Which
and then,
is honestly, and it goes back to, you know, like you're saying, those, the Wire is so big on that.
Yeah.
I mean, because you never get to see the collateral damage of these procedurals. I mean, like when you look at Law and Order, there's at least like 50 people per episode that are being fucked over left and right. And
also the people that they're arresting probably are never going to prison.
Yeah.
You know, because that's the thing, is like, they're not going to go to trial for like a year and then something will happen by then, you know, and that's just, it's the fucked up nature of the criminal justice system. And that's what Richard Price understands so well.
Yeah.
And so I think that it was such an inspired choice to basically be like we can get a horror guy to head up. We can get Scott Gimple from The Walking Dead to head this up, you know, or we can get Richard Price, you know, to head this up. And obviously they had that relationship with him from The Night Of. They were probably searching for a project. And then
to couple it with like Bateman's company also.
Yes.
With Ozark. I mean, it's
Jen, have you seen Ozark?
I have. Yeah. Well, I've seen the first season, but I was thinking also when I was watching, I was like, it feels so much like Ozark.
Yeah. And that's what I think is interesting about The Outsiders, is creatively there's a merging between Price's universe and the creative talent that work on Ozark, because the Andrew Bernstein, who directs episodes 3 and 4, I believe, he was he's a director and I think a producer on Ozark. And then obviously Bateman's involved, and the guy who plays Jack, Mark Menchaca, who is incredible. He's like one of my favorite character actors working right now. He is he's I don't know, Jen, if you remember the guy with the big red beard in the first season of Ozark.
Yeah,
that's the same guy who he plays Jack. I know, I didn't recognize him either. I like was like, how do I know that guy? And then I was like, oh shit, he's great though. And he was my favorite part of Ozark. So I think that merging of talent, I think, was pretty inspired. But the question is that, and this is, I guess, what I want to, we're talking about the delicate balance, right? And I think this is a good time to talk about that, which is we, in these first three episodes,
because we can't talk about the next
we won't spoil anything later, but it's like these first three episodes are really introducing us into this procedural crime world, really gritty, really dark, cops, lawyers, killers, things like that. And then but by the end of episode three, like we're getting hints of this, of something odd is going on. Obviously Jason Bateman's Terry Maitland is seen at two different places. Holly starts talking about doppelgangers. They're finding his clothes in a barn, and his fingerprints are degraded. Like some of them are fresh, some of them are old. Like they're like, well, it's Terry, but when he's 80, and they're the same DNA. And so they can't explain it. There's all this weird goo that's all over the clothes. And then we see Jack, who is basically this alcoholic cop who's kind of an asshole. He basically, something happens to him that causes a lot of boils and bumps on his neck, and he's clearly been attacked by something that doesn't seem human. So we're toying with the supernatural, and in these first three episodes, how do you guys think that balance is working?
Jen, you want to kick that one off?
Yeah, I think it's actually, so the first two episodes, I was shocked at how fast it went, because that's like probably 200 pages of the first half of the book, you know? And I was like, oh Lord, what are they going to do with the rest of this? But then like it started to turn into more about the characters rather than the plotting. And it almost felt like they were setting up in the first two episodes. And I think the transition is happening really well. I'm really invested. And I think I'm more excited to finish the show than I was to finish the book.
It's interesting, because what I've noticed is the trajectory of the supernatural in this show almost works in the same way that we do as human beings as we age. I mean, a lot of the supernatural presence comes from, you know, the darkness. We see it through the point of view of the children, that like, you know, something's in the room, something has been in the room. And then it evolves into, you know, the adults that are having to kind of contend with this, like, sort of punctures in reality. And I think it was really smart to actually kind of start a little bit more with the kids, at least with the, like the more explicit supernatural stuff that's there, because obviously you see the stuff that's in the footage, you see the, you know, the really jarring, terrifying stuff where, you know, the Bateman too you know, Terry too is, you know, walking through the footage and he's like staring at it, and he's definitely self-aware.
I love it.
Just some of the scariest things I've seen on television in a while. But even then, that stuff is still like of the earth, you know, like you still see like, all right, well, that's a human being on the footage. Okay, it's obviously contextually there's something off about this. But when it gets to the real supernatural stuff, it's at a distance. It's at a sort of cerebral level that almost feels like infantile. Like, you know, and a lot of it comes down to with, you know, the kids, see, you know, Terry's kids seeing something in the room. And then also even just in the distance when like your mind kind of plays tricks with you, you're like, well, is that person staring at me?
Yeah.
You know, is that person aware of, you know, who I am and what actually is happening on this show? And which is why I think like being able to start from that sort of like the, you know, it's funny, it's all in the titular, it's all in the title. It's this outside presence that just continues to keep coming closer and closer into the actual story frame. And a lot of it is with that hooded character.
Yeah, you see this hooded character,
you know,
who
that
has a face.
Something's fucking off.
Yeah,
there.
That something's off. And then you hear from Jessa, Terry's daughter, that she saw this figure four times.
Yep.
And the first time it kind of looked like her dad.
Yep.
The second time it barely looked like her dad. And then it started to look like something else.
So you're getting these seeds. Yeah. Essentially. And it's the same, and again, I go back to, like, it's the same way that we kind of grapple with the supernatural as humans, and we hear about it as kids, and then we kind of question it and question it and question it as we get older. And you know, some of us become Ralph and some of us become
Holly.
I guess Holly, yeah, in a sense, but you know, she even is able to question it sometimes. But the way that they've laid out the seeds is so smart, because while the story does move pretty swift in those first two episodes, mm-hmm, the more like supernatural or cultish elements are sparsely, you know, laid out. And I think that's smart. And so by the time you actually get to the, you know, ectoplasm in the barn, you're kind of on board. You mm-hmm know, it's like almost like the first two episodes were like the longest cold open of an X-Files episode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know? And you're like, okay, yeah, I'm here on it. I can, I buy this now. Something's fucking weird.
Yeah. I do wonder, though, for people who check in for more of a, because they're more Richard Price fans than they are Stephen King fans, is it going to be, you know, will this transition, will the, because like I'd say, like the introduction of Holly sort of signals, and what happens to Jack sort of signals like the pivot. Because the first two episodes, you can take a few things away, like the hooded character and like clearly the daughter seeing something. But it could also just be like one of those crime cases where it's like, what is the answer? And like, that's what people love, is that sense of what is the practical fact-based, like evidence-based answer to this.
Well, and it's like the first season of True Detective.
Yeah,
I mean, and that's why I brought it up in my review for COS, is because, like, you know, what I loved about that first season that I was personally disappointed on is that they spend, Cary Fukunaga spends at least like 75% of that season leaning on the idea or hinting at the idea that there's something beyond just this, you know, killer.
Yeah,
and you know, you can kind of make what you will with the ending when he sees like the swirling, you know, cyclone over the Yellow King's base, I guess. Mm-hmm. And kind of see like, well, what is reality, what's not. But like, it pretty much leans on the fact that like most of it was just more of like cerebral, you know, talk
that
he was having, guff. And this is like literal, like, no, there is something happening here.
Yeah.
And so there's that I really do love, mm-hmm, because I've been wanting that sort of mix.
Yeah.
We're not going to obviously talk about the next three episodes, but I definitely think that the delicate dance that they have in these first three, it gets a little crazier at some points,
mm-hmm,
you know, just as a forewarning. But I think in these three episodes right now, you really do, like, it's agreeable. Like, you know, and then you could still be the Ralph and be like, nah, it's bullshit.
Yeah.
But you could also still be the Holly, where you're actually doing like the legwork and you're like seeing that, okay, these things are starting to add up. And
yeah. And it's pointing towards an answer that is, you know, not one that Ben Mendelsohn's character would probably like.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I guess like for me, it's going to be really interesting. And I think Jen and I, as people who have read the book, we know, you know, like we said, it's a Stephen King book. It really is a Stephen King book. And so it's that threading that needle. That's going to be my number one thing, is A, can they stick the landing? Because the ending is, you know, very Kingian. And and will Price be able to stick that landing, and will people want to go on that journey?
Well, here's another question, and this is something that I don't know if we could really answer, but like, you know, what is the landing? Is it going to be a limited series, or is it going to be an actual first season? Because that's something that I keep thinking about left and right.
Yeah.
Like, because they've said that this is a first season.
Well, have they publicly said that?
I mean, I've seen it like listed. I mean, like, even when you like look up on HBO, it'll say it on there. But they also did that with Watchmen. So, you know.
Well, I'll just say that in writing up The Outsider, I was asked by somebody who worked at HBO to remove the word limited from series in one of my write-ups. So,
I was kind of teeing you up for that story, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I don't want to say too much, but I think that was an interesting tell that they might see. I think that they will finish the book The Outsider this season. Like Jen said, it was 200 pages in those first two episodes. They flew through it, you know? And so I do think that there is the possibility for more, but maybe we can talk about what that second season would look like in a moment. But I guess I also want to hear about I want to talk about Holly a little bit, because I feel like Holly kind of shakes things up in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
And as somebody who's read, and you've read Mr. Mercedes as well, Jen?
I have. Yeah, I've read the trilogy.
Nice. So I would love to hear from you about how you think book Holly compares to Cynthia Erivo's Holly on this series. Because I think that, you know, they're definitely... I don't think Mr. Mercedes exists in the canon of The Outsider based on how they framed her upbringing in the show. Yeah. So I'm curious what you think about how the character is presented here versus in the book.
Well, I have liked Holly all through the Hodges trilogy, and I liked her a lot in The Outsider, but watching the show, this is the first time I've really loved her.
Yeah.
And I think she is just, she's bringing, in just one episode that I've seen, she's really bringing this strength and vulnerability to this part that I think is on the page, but I think it's really coming alive here. And mm-hmm. It's amazing. Like she almost made me cry a couple of times in that third episode where just when with her hand on the bar and she was just breathing, it's like, oh, and when she called him and said, I just need to hear a voice who's on my side.
Mm-hmm.
But she doesn't let her guard down. Like you just see this strong woman who advocates for what she needs. And I love that. And I don't think that really comes out fully in the books, in any of the four books, you know?
Yeah, I actually completely agree with that. I'm very taken with her performance. Mm-hmm. And for me, it's because she really downplays the quirky qualities and internalizes them into a way where they're part of the fabric of her character rather than things that make her odd. Like her oddness is something that is so baked into the performance. Like, and like you said, the vulnerability is really there. And there is this sort of like strength, but also this like scared bunny quality to her performance that I think is really appealing. And also, I think it's sort of her matter of fact deliveries as well. Like there's nothing sort of, there's nothing like precious about, whereas I feel like the character can read as a bit precious on the page. I think
very
that
affected.
Yeah, there's nothing precious about the delivery and the way that she's doing this character. So for you, you've heard about Holly from the discussions we've had in the pod, but what did you think about her in the series?
So when when we first get to see, you know, the episode three, it's a little jarring just because there's a stoicism to her that works in juxtaposition to everyone else that we've just been watching in like the first two episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a stoicism to, you know, to Ralph and Ben Mendelsohn's performance, but it comes from a sense of like, you know, grief, because that's another difference that's here is that, you know, his son is dead in this and he's gotten this, like, there's a little more depth to that. And I kind of can see it. So when you first meet Holly, it's very like, it almost feels, like a different show at first, just because it is. I mean, she's an outside influence at this point. And,
you could say she's an outsider.
She is an outsider. Yeah. Yeah. Right. There are many outsiders in this. let's just keep tagging that to everyone in the show. But so, you know, that first episode with her, it did take a little warming up, like early on for me, just because it was like, I was just so used to like the remedial cop.
Yeah.
You know,
well, there's not much quirk to anyone else.
No.
On the series.
No,
and then you've got her and she's like, I know the lyrics to every rock song, but I hate music.
And you're kinda it's like, that type of stuff. That was,
and that's like, I think the closest it came to being precious, because then I'm just kind of like, I don't know if I believe this character.
Yeah.
But then you know, I think that she does ease you into the character as you go.
So. By the end of episode three, I'm totally on board. By four, might be her like four or five is like where she really just kind of takes control. And that by then, you're like, wow, okay, I could kind of see them just, I could see why King is attracted to this character and continues to bring, you know, him back on.
Yeah.
But then again, I've never read anything with Holly in it. So.
Well, I think he's very into the idea, like, all crime authors have their characters that they have their books, you know, like a Holly Gibney book, you know,
like
and
Sherlock
they'll revisit and tell these procedural stories with. I think he's very taken with the idea of having his own one of those, and Holly is that for him. And so...
Well, Outsider season two, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. That's what I was kind of thinking was, you know, if they do want to do another season, is it going to be the continuing adventures of Holly Gibney? But
Chronicles.
Yeah. But it's like Cynthia just got nominated for an Oscar. So does she want to stick around for a TV show, even if it's on HBO? You know,
I know. And what's just so great is that like there's a lot of nuance to the performance and just the way that it's a very physical performance.
Yeah.
Because like every little, you know, like every shrug, every stare that she gives to a lot of the characters. I really love, I can't remember if this is in the third episode or not, and I don't want to spoil it, but there's a connection that she has to a certain character on the case.
Yes.
That I just love so much, because it's not explicit at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's very implicit, and there's a lot of inferences in that relationship and what they get from each other.
Yeah.
And I think that bond speaks to her performance and just how much she's able to kind of instill in every scene with just the lightest little of you know, affection or inflections that she puts on it. So, and that is absolutely a testament to Erivo, like, because you know, that you're not, there's nothing script, you know, there's nothing scripted about that, you know? So,
well, it's interesting because, you know, she does bring in a lot of new, what's what I'm looking for, elements to, like, texture to the story. And that I think, you know, I think that people, if you did feel a little bit maybe put off by her presence in the third episode, because, you know, it's those first two episodes are so grim, you know, they're so dark. Like, my wife walked in, she was just watching little bits of it. She's like, this shit is unrelentingly grim. Because you've literally got, you know, Bateman just getting, like, you meet him, he's a nice dad, and then he is just drugged through hell, these two episodes, and then fucking shot, like, unceremoniously. Yeah.
So here's the question. I had a question on that. So, and I had, my girlfriend's reading right now, and she says that in the book, it's pretty explicit that he's dead.
Yeah.
And in the show, they're very mercurial about it. Like, it's all like, you know, they're holding his wound, and then it cuts.
Yeah.
And then they don't mention anything until, I think it's when he's talking to, was it district attorney?
Yeah.
And he's like, all right, well, we've got to deal with this, you know, like the Maitland family is going to have their fucking hands, our heads on a plate or something like that. But it's very interesting how subtle they don't really, I mean, you don't really see him in the autopsy room. You don't really see his, you know, I mean, eventually, you know, they have to deal with, like,
maybe Bateman could only film so many scenes.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Like, I'm not just going to sit around in an autopsy table for you guys.
Right.
I got to go film Ozark.
We were watching the third episode, and my husband looked at me and was like, wait, he's dead?
Yeah.
And he had not picked up that he had died.
Yeah. That's how it was for me.
I think it's really shocking for people because they probably think Bateman's going to be one of the leads.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's, you know, when I read the book, I thought Terry was going to be one of the leads. And then when he dies, it's a shock, you know? But I think that is what sort of, you know, propels Ralph. And I think also by giving him, making his son dead, it adds to the darkness and the grimness of the whole thing. But I like the choice because I think it does motivate him a little bit more. And I do like those moments where you see, you know, the grief that he went through, you know, in the wake of his son dying. You see him, you know, fighting at a bar. He talks about him and his wife almost splitting. I think that there's, I think that stylistically, one of the things that I've enjoyed about, I think stylistically, direction-wise, because Bateman directed the first two episodes.
Yeah, which is funny because he stars in those and then he dies. It's like, why didn't you just wait until you're dead so you don't have to do double duty? But
well, that was probably his, because I think he probably wanted to set the visual palette for the show, you know? And and that's what you get to do when you direct the pilot. Yeah. You know, it's like,
maybe
this
maybe there's two Batemans, like in real life.
But I think one of the things I've enjoyed, though, is I feel like they've leavened the grief and the grimness of it by kind of twofold. And one of them is stylistically. I think that it helps that they focus so much on the procedural aspects because I think that gives people that Law and Order fuzziness that, you know, is that comfort food that you get from that kind of show. So you're able, they never linger too long on sort of the massive, you know, like you got the Peterson family just self-destructing left and right and screaming. But what they do, I think, is when whenever there are those moments of intense grief, sobbing, screaming, crying, all that, or fighting, it's like they usually drop out the volume and they let the soundtrack kind of do the heavy lifting.
Yeah.
And I think that I always think that's a smart move because sometimes when you're depicting grief, you don't want to be reductive and not show the extent of it, but also nobody really wants to watch people scream for an extended period of time. And I think that that's something that, when you're dealing with grief, it's often best to work in silence, I think.
And there's also some really great details in these first few episodes that kind of just show just how dour a lot of things are. Like, even when, you know, like Mayor Winningham, who's you know, Ben Mendelsohn's wife, yep, in the show. She's so great in this too, because like everyone nails their nuances in this show, mm-hmm, for the most part. But it's like the little things, like if with them, it's like, you know, them coming to this house where they don't turn on any lights, even though it's getting dark outside, and they're talking about like, oh, well, won't we just do carry out or, you know, take out, yeah, or whatever. And there's just like this sort of like, they're just living to live. Yeah. And like that sort of those little subtleties, like, are all throughout this, like these first few episodes. And I love it so much because it really just speaks to, you know, Price's genius as a writer. But it also, what you're saying, like, it gives you that sense of grief, like without having to say like, our kid's dead, yeah, you know, yeah, and like having to show so many, like, you know, scenes of Ben Mendelsohn getting in fights in the bar, because like all we need is that one little scene, that's it. Yeah. And like, you know,
when he does visit the grave, it's not to sob over it. No. It's just like, I wish I could tell you about my week, you know?
Yeah.
And those moments are really powerful.
It's their day to day.
Yeah.
You know,
what do you guys think about Ben Mendelsohn's performance?
I think this is his best performance yet.
Nice.
Yeah, I really do.
It's amazing. His eyes are just so warm, yeah, you know? And I was saying, I kept mixing him and Jack up for a little bit, because I think they could, like, especially working in the same office, they kind of, even though their characters are polar opposites, there's just this warmth he has in his eyes. And when his face falls, you feel the emotion in his eyes, even though he's not really doing anything else. Mm-hmm. And I think that really sells his character. And I think, like, what you're talking about the subtle details, that's something that King does very well.
Yeah.
And he is able to really make you feel like you're living in the house with this family who's lost this child. And I think lots of adaptations fail because they just can't get those nuances down. Mm-hmm. And because King writes a lot of it inside the heads of his characters. And I think the subtle shift of having Derek dead and not just away, I think gives us kind of an entryway into that without having to like explain why he feels the way he does, mm-hmm, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's definitely a great addendum to this. Like, it's when I found out that he's not actually dead in the book, I was like, well, wait, what is the character even like then?
Yeah.
Because he's just, it's such a totally different
I'll
character.
I'll say this. Yeah. Like when I read the book, Ralph didn't make much of an impact on me.
Yeah.
But I think in this series, Mendelsohn's performance is like filled with depth, and then you give him just a little bit more character. And also, I mean, I'd say the relationship with his wife is well drawn, mm-hmm, in the book. Mm-hmm. And I think just, that's probably one of the better aspects of the book, but here that is just one of many really great.
It explains so much. Like, it explains why he would be somewhat contemptuous to, you know, when his wife is actually experiencing some of the things, and, you, mm-hmm, know, and because the way he's dealt with grief is by leaning more on pragmatism, you know, mm-hmm, like, or he's far more pragmatic because he's, you know, he's experienced the grief of losing someone. So he knows that, like, you know, there's this like kind of sense of this like lack of like hope, you know, mm-hmm, and like when you have, mm-hmm, that sort of lack of hope, it's almost like the narrative for Mel Gibson in Signs, where like, you know, he loses his wife, so he like loses his belief in God. And I think that like the sense that he lost that, you know, his child also explains, it's like, no, fuck, there is nothing out there. Like, you know, this is, I'm not going to go and there is an answer to everything, you know, which is why I understand why there's a little bit more of a foundation to him, and why he's not going to, you know, lean immediately to try to go like, oh yeah, no, I believe everything. Like there's going to be some sort of fight there. Yeah. And that grief informs that fight in a way that I just can't see being like, oh, my kid's at summer camp. I miss him.
I love seeing that he's going to therapy too. Like, I think, yeah, in three episodes, we've seen two therapy sessions with him, and they were both like, varying to different degrees. And like, I think that's we don't see a lot of men do that on TV.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that we're seeing that, especially like, I go to a lot of therapy and it's really helpful. And I appreciate seeing a person struggle with that and struggle with what to open up about and when. And that I think led us into his character a lot too, because we're starting to see his walls come down just a little bit, but just enough to know where they are, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and honestly, like, there's like this interesting kind of arc that he has, even with the way he like speaks with like those in his department.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah,
like, he's almost like everyone almost like keeps him at an arm's length because of his history.
Yeah.
And I think that also kind of helps too. Like he's technically not even on this case.
Right.
and it's, but everyone's okay with the fact that like he is actually just coming back. Like,
yeah.
It's like, well, all right, he has his own sort of ways to process things. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the depth of characters to this show is what's really keeping me hooked, even beyond just the mystery of what the hell this all means and what this hell this all, you know, is going to lead to, which is honestly like what I loved about The Night Of.
Yeah.
You know, like I wasn't tuning in just for the sake of like, oh, is he guilty or is he not guilty? Like, yeah. I didn't really care.
Right.
I almost just wanted to see like how these characters are going to evolve, like, yeah. Where are they going to go next? And he's so good at doing that.
Well, in terms of horror too, it's like, Jen, you mentioned earlier about how it's not, you know, with Price, it's not traditional horror, but it's still very scary. Mm-hmm. And I think that we see that here too. Like, I would say some of the scariest moments for me is like the end of the first episode, I believe, when Bateman's in prison and that guy across the cell is like, basically, we're going to kill you, yeah. Like whispering.
Right.
Yeah. Like that shit is so, and like even just the prison intake scenes with Terry and then just the ways that they treat him because they think he's a kid killer and all these things, that to me is so scary. And also, yeah. The idea of Gloria, I think her name's Gloria,
Gloria,
like his wife, the fact that they're becoming pariahs, yep. in the neighborhood because they're affiliated with him.
Well, that's the most unnerving aspect of the entire series for me so far. And even going beyond episode 3, because spoiler alert, but you know, society doesn't come around so fast. And that's kind of really scary, especially in an age where, and not to get all like on a soapbox and everything, where there is no gray area for people. Like, it's black or white. Like, the minute that you are tagged, like, you're stuck with that forever.
Well, that's why arresting him at the baseball game is such a big deal.
Yeah.
He could have done it quietly, but he's so angry. And that's a big part in the book, too.
Yeah.
And something that I think is really powerful is that he's so mad and the evidence is so clear. The forensic evidence is so clear that he's like, well, he clearly did it. Let's humiliate him in front of the whole town.
And then, it'll help in the case.
Yeah, and that is like, and then I love that moment when Jason Bateman says to him in the car, he's like, you just ruined my life.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. So understated too.
Mm-hmm.
Just the weight of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the feeling of powerlessness. And that was something that I was getting so angry when I was reading the book and I was starting to feel that. It was like the first episode is like a ticking clock to when he gets arrested at the baseball game. And if you know that's what's going to happen, it's like, and the arraignment, I was like, oh, don't do it. I don't do it. I know. And I knew it was going to happen, but I was just begging these characters to make different choices because like just the tiniest little decisions that you make, really the ramifications to everyone in the situation are just like life changing.
I mean, and honestly, you see it. And I mean, I don't know if I know you definitely didn't watch this documentary, but you know, it's like the Don't Mess With Cats.
Oh, I can't watch it.
Yeah, there's no way you can mess it. There's no way. I knew it. But
I love
like
my kitty too
what
much.
They talk about that in this doc though. Like, it's just that, like, you know, the minute that you are, you know, put in this light, like you are there forever.
Yeah.
And this is why, honestly, like it led to at one point in the documentary, which deals with this total sociopath that was got really too into American Psycho. He ended up killing all these cats. And, you know, some guy online joked and said, oh, it was me. But then he was like, no, it actually wasn't me. But the fact is like, nope, you already had everyone throwing stones at you.
Oh,
that's going to stay with you forever. And he ended up killing himself because he was like, nobody would believe me. And
spoiler alert.
And like, yeah, spoiler for like a 10-year-old true crime story. But like, it made me think, like, you know, yeah, like even if Maitland wasn't shot outside the courthouse and, you know, they do go through with this. Like,
oh, his life is over.
It's over. It is over.
Right.
And especially in a small town like this.
Yeah.
And King is so adamant on talking about that. I mean, he talks about Needful Things, like, you know, the towns talk and things stick with you.
And that's where I think you really see the overlap between Price and King, because one of the things King emphasizes in the book is the ripple effect of the crime. And that's what Price is so good at.
Yep.
And so I think that's where, like, it was so inspired to bring them together, because Price is so good at building out the world of a crime and the ways that it spreads its tendrils. And I think that question moving forward, because Mike and I have not seen every episode, like, we don't know how it,
only
I mean,
seen six.
Yeah. We're excited to see where it goes, but it's like, will he be able, because I went through his IMDb too and his books, and I was like, did he ever like really dip into Supernatural? And he never did.
It's
and
not
so,
even remotely like hinted. Like,
yeah.
It's
and especially
not even, like,
since
a cerebral
it's,
drama.
If it's him and Lehane that are mainly working on this, Lehane's also not a Supernatural guy. So it'll be interesting to see how they do it. And, but they did bring on Karen Kusama, who directs a later episode, the director of Jennifer's Body and The Invitation. What else has she done?
She did Girl Fight.
Oh, Girl Fight.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. So she's not like primarily horror, but she does horror well.
Well, it's interesting too is that. So,
oh, and Destroyer too.
So there's only one other writer that's on there, and it's Jesse Nixon Lopez. And I want to say, I can't remember if the. I'm not going to spoil anything, but there is a scene that gets into. I keep saying it's It Chapter 2 territory.
Yeah.
And it involves a certain character, and it's very Kingian. But I can't remember if it was in the sixth episode or the fifth episode.
It was in the sixth episode.
Okay, so it's so then that episode was written by Dennis Lehane.
Oh, okay, interesting.
Yeah, so
yeah, I think like once we get to, and we'll do an episode revisiting after the finale and probably talk about the latter part. Yeah. And Jen, maybe you could join us for that. And yeah, and we'll talk about how these supernatural elements really fit in, and if Price and these crime guys were able to, you know, sort of really land on that. Any final thoughts on The Outsider?
One more thing is, this isn't an episode of Losers Club if I don't take us to Hawkins, Indiana, small town, because guess what? Jesse Nixon Lopez is an executive story editor on Stranger Things.
Oh, nice.
So
interesting.
You know, hey, bringing some of that small town charm to The Outsider also.
I'm into it.
Yeah,
what if Steve Harrington
yeah, what if he
up,
pops
up? Crossover.
I didn't kill Dustin, Ralph. He's in his Scoops Ahoy uniform when they rain him. Anyway, yeah.
Jen, how would you compare The Outsider to the last, because we're in the midst of this Stephen King renaissance, like, and, you know, obviously, I think some of the adaptations we've gotten over the last few years, some are good, some aren't. Yeah. Where would you sort of place The Outsider, you know, in near the top or the bottom of these new crop of King stories coming out?
I think I would probably place it very, very close to the top.
Yeah.
I think, especially for TV. I loved the first season of Castle Rock, and I loved Dr. Sleep, and I loved Gerald's Game. But I feel like this one, I think they get what makes the story a King story, but they're presenting it in a way that's true to the difference from him too. And I think it's just so compelling, and the quality and the writing, it's so well done. I would put it way up at the top.
Yeah.
And on that note, because they're getting at what the Stephen King story is, since you both have read it, and you've both read a lot of his true crime stuff too, would you say that having Price involved actually elevates King's true crime muscle?
Yes. 100%.
Which is in a way that he can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like, yeah. I wrote in my review, it's like, nobody's turning to King for his crime novels. I mean, like, you read King for horror, or you love King and you read everything he writes, you know? There's not people who just say, I get my crime fix from Stephen King, you know? So, I think, but a lot of people would say, I do get my crime fix from Richard Price, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think bringing Lehane on, really sort of gives a credibility to the procedural aspects and the investigative aspects that is there in King's book, but it goes deeper. And, like, and it's the culture of the prison, of the courthouse, of all of that stuff. That's like the stuff that Price is so intimately familiar with. And he can add that, he can give that weight, he can bring that horror, which is a very real life horror. And you know, and they film it in the same way. Like, I kind of love that slow like dread inducing like, he films the horror elements of the show very, or at least they film the horror elements of the show very similar that they do to the real life kind of terror, which is, you know, that scene in the prison. It's like that dark cell, and you're just hearing the voice for a while saying, like, I'm gonna kill you or whatever.
And honestly, the pilot for The Night Of, the first episode of the Night Of is very similar to the first episode here.
Yeah,
like, you could probably play them side by side and see a lot of the similarities in terms of just
pacing and
the sort of nihilistic sensibilities that come from knowing your life is over and just like, well, all right, all bets are off at this point. Like,
and that might be why it rubs some people the wrong way. I was surprised that there were a couple, like, not just bad reviews, but like aggressively bad reviews.
I was really shocked by that.
I think that, you know, I think some people think it's boring, but for me personally, I like that. I like the pace. I'm invested in the characters, and it works for me. So it's, That, yeah. So I reject that hypothesis.
Is that an Adam Sandler quote from Uncut Gems?
No, I disagree. I love it. No, so yeah, I would also put it near the top. This has been my favorite, and I'm glad that we like it, because I feel like on this pod we've you know, maybe have a couple times come across as negative Nancys. But
what if I just came out right now and it's like, actually I think it's shit. What? No, I just spent 40 minutes.
It feels good to really love something. We like Dr. Sleep a lot.
I like Dr. Sleep a lot. Yeah. Although even that turned out to be polarizing too, with a lot of people that were diehard like fans of the book, which is crazy to me.
Yeah. And so, but I think last year it was kind of an up and down year in terms of King adaptations, mostly down. And
I
so,
think mostly down.
Yeah,
honestly.
And so I think it's good to kick off 2020 with this. And, you know, it bodes well, hopefully. I mean, we just got some bad news about The Dark Tower that we're going to talk about next week, about that series. Visit our socials if you haven't heard that news. But then, you know, we've got The Stand coming out this year, which is going to be huge. And then we've got Lycie Story also coming out.
Which
on
I
Apple.
Think is more likely to be on par with this.
I'm hoping so. I mean, great talent on it. Yeah. So it's, and you know, I didn't realize Pablo Larraín, who directed Jackie, is
helming
all the episodes.
Yeah, no, everyone, it's the same type of thing where it's like the talent behind the camera and in front of the camera is up the
I'll
quality.
Be curious to, because King's writing all the episodes, and I'll be curious how that pans out, because his scripts are you know, not always the best.
Hey, Pet Sematary, the original one, was still great.
I agree. So. We're are you a Pet Sematary fan, Jen, the original film?
Yeah, I am.
Yeah, we are too. We're like, I almost feel like I'm an apologist for it, because I feel like we love it on the pod, but I feel like everyone I meet in the real world like thinks it's so dumb.
I know.
And I'm just like,
I was kind of shocked.
And
about
I say
that.
I disagree. Like Adam Sandler.
You gotta know what you're getting into, you know. I mean, it's not perfect, but it's just gotta love it, you know.
Yeah, I would go so far as to argue that the original Pet Sematary captures the small town vibe of Stephen King better than any other movies I've seen.
Bold statement.
I really do. Like, it just, in a lot of it, it's because it actually is filmed in Maine.
Yeah.
And that so much of it was made out of love with the community, because, I mean, you watch that documentary, it's on Shudder, I believe, right now. It's like Unearthed or something like that.
Oh, yeah. We watched that.
And what's great about watching that is that you get the sense that, like, Maine understood what makes the world of Stephen King, but also knew what the stuff of Maine to put on the screen. And, you know, and I don't know, I love it. That's one of the reasons why I love that movie so much, because it feels like what I'm reading on the pages,
right,
in my head. But anyway, we don't have to go down that road.
You could go back and listen to our Pet Sematary, three Pet Sematary episodes, which
episodes.
Some of you, when you were voting on our little quiz recently, said you liked a lot, and maybe the favorite episodes.
We have four episodes, technically, five if you really include the remake stuff from last year.
Oh, but, yeah.
You know, or reimagining.
And we also interviewed Mary Lambert.
Yes, we did.
Which was awesome.
That was a fun interview.
So, very cool. Anyways, little sidebar. Go listen to our Pet Sematary shit. Well, thanks so much. Jen, did you want to stick around for our Castle Rock chat?
Sure.
Okay, cool. Jen's going to stick around.
She's going to stick around. Hey, let's go from, we were just in Ludlow seeing the good old Creed family, a bunch of zombies walking around, depending on what reimagining you want to go for. And let's go to Castle Rock.
Yeah, let's go to Castle Rock.
We're searchers, you and me. But you deserve a chance to make a place in the world. See, I'm a searcher who just wants to settle. Wants it bad. Just can't seem to find that place that'll live up to you, my perfection.
Here we are in Castle Rock. I'm wearing football gear to protect myself from all of the
hatred
from all the people who want to beat me up for not liking Castle Rock season 2.
I'm in the back of Glorium Emporium because there happens to be some, you know, haunted, possessed people that are trying to kill me, and Annie Wilkes has a shotgun. And
so let's go back and Jen, you've seen the first two episodes of the second season?
I have seen the first two. So I'm standing in the Stargazer parking lot wondering what the hell is going on here.
All right, but here's the thing. You said, all right, this is what you sent me on Twitter today. I was like, I just watched the first two episodes. That was a lot.
Yeah.
So, could you share your thoughts on the first two episodes? You know, I'm interested to see where you're at on that.
Yeah. So the first episode, I was really into it, and I liked, I love Lizzie Kaplan, and I love Tim Robbins. And I was like, okay, how can we lose? And I love Ace Merrill. So I was like, okay, this is going to be great. And then it just was like, it almost felt like Stephen King Easter egg porn at a point. Like somebody said, the line, like, you better be asleep or dead, I shit you not. And I was like, yay, they said the line. And then I was like, oh, wait, but they're telling a story. And I was just thinking, what is going on? Because it feels like seven different stories.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love the story they're telling with Annie, but I wish she weren't Annie.
Yes.
You know?
That's literally
what you're, like, echoing all of our things.
Yeah, this is exactly all the stuff that we were saying.
I think,
you
know? I think, I remember feeling the similar, but after I watched the first two episodes, I remember texting our text thread and saying something like, I feel like I'm on drugs. I have no idea what this show is doing.
Yeah.
It is. Mm-hmm. But I think at this point, maybe I love it. And I said that because I was like, it seems like it's going full crazy. And
yeah.
Like, because I struggle, you know, I think just to clear, like, we struggled because, for me, and I, you know, and this is where I got a little annoyed by some people, like some of the people who really like the show, is this whole concept of you know, it's not like it, I don't care that it doesn't adhere to the book canon. Like, I don't care that it really fucks with the history of Annie and Ace Merrill and Pop Merrill,
yeah,
and the whole history of Castle Rock. They're like, I don't care. And to me, I wish I could be that carefree.
Exactly.
But I am like, no, it, like, Ace Merrill has an entire rich, interesting history in mm-hmm. the world of Castle Rock. Pop Merrill has a fascinating, interesting, rich history of Castle Rock.
The Glorium Emporium doesn't even exist, technically, because, you know,
well, that's the whole thing, is like, in the world of Castle Rock Season 2, Needful Things didn't happen, and the Sundog didn't happen, and...
But maybe it did.
But like, the thing is, they make all these references to it. So mm-hmm. that really, that's when we say Easter egg porn. That's what this is.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. where, and then you name a character Ace Merrill, but aside from him being kind of a shit kicker asshole, he shares nothing in common with Ace Merrill. And mm-hmm. like, they did a little bit more with Pop, and I think a lot of that maybe had to do with Tim Robbins because he's so great. And I love Paul Sparks as an actor too, but they just gave nothing to him as
it
Ace.
It should have been Garrett Hedlund.
I think, and then I think with Annie, it was complicated because it was so unclear to us, like, had she already had this experience with Paul, like Paul Sheldon,
mm-hmm.
Because they hinted, they had that in the first episode, there's that moment with the wheelchair.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have, like, her seeing this spirit and these typewriter sounds.
Yep.
And it's mm-hmm. like, okay, so that's Paul, right? And then it ends up not being Paul.
But they're
and
preying upon that twist
exactly.
by you thinking that it is Paul.
Yes.
Which makes no fucking sense.
And this is where I struggle, because then it sets it. Okay, are you guys, this is, we're talking about the ending now.
Okay.
So is that okay?
Yeah, I'm good.
Okay. Like, it sets up at the end. It ends with her at a reading for Paul Sheldon.
Which is just.
So it's like, oh, okay.
Jackie Torrance all over again.
Premonition.
Yeah, so, but it's like, well, no, there's because, this no, well, there's this whole backstory that they give her where her dad was an aspiring writer and like she was his biggest fan and everything, but then he got remarried or he married her at-home teacher and then she
had
lost
baby,
him
and then
like, but then suddenly her dad's impaled on on the stairway, like, railing or whatever.
He trips and, like, after she's running down the stairs.
It's insane.
It's ridiculous.
And it's really,
it's
really
Ryan
bad.
Murphy level insanity.
Like, it's hard to unpack all this. It's just basically like, this is a show this season wanted, like, whereas, and you said you love the first season. We were fans too. We struggled with the ending, but overall we liked the first season because we, and I would say the reason that I argue for the first season and say that it's solid was it wasn't an Easter egg factory.
No.
The only Easter egg factory there was Jackie Torrance, which was dumb.
Just
and that was
dumb.
The worst part of the season.
And clearly, and I still argue to this, is that I'm sure the Hulu saw that and like, more of that.
Yeah.
And less of, you whereas, know, these new characters.
Because
like
you bring in Pangborn and, yeah, like, we didn't hear a lot about Polly Chalmers or anything, but at the same time, that's fine, because yeah, we didn't need that, and it's been many years, and, but the Pangborn that existed in Castle Rock Season 1, even if he didn't embody every aspect of Pangborn in King's books, he still felt like he was part of the world and had been through what Pangborn had been through.
And they were working within the pages.
Yes.
And that was my biggest thing, was that, like, you know, you're going to go and create a show called Castle Rock, like, and if you want to take the names and the bold, you know, things and whatever and go with it and do your own thing, like, maybe do that from the get-go, but that first season is pretty goddamn beholden to what King already set out to
well,
do.
Yeah, the,
I mean,
the
you
only,
see the, you yeah, literally see, like, in the first episode, all the headlines and newspaper clippings of, like, the past books, mm-hmm, as if to say, this lore is here.
Yeah.
It, and we're going to be respectful
this
of
happened.
It.
And the only character they brought in from, you know, the canon was Alan Pangborn, like,
yeah,
I said.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, it makes sense. And also, he felt of the world, he felt of the books, but he also felt like a new character within the show. Mm-hmm. And then they also, all the other characters, they played with the archetypes that King likes to play with.
Yep.
The mm-hmm, town felt real. You yeah, know, the town felt like the town. It felt like a Stephen King story in so many ways. And that's what I think really worked. It wasn't, there were Easter eggs, sure, but they were small. They weren't shoved in your face. It wasn't, you know, Jackie Torrance was the prime offender. And, but then season two just felt like, okay, we want a character named Annie Wilkes and we want Lizzie, who Lizzie's great. I love her. But we want her to do a Kathy Bates, you know, I think she finds a lot of nuance within the impersonation, but it is an impersonation.
Yeah.
And she, you know, we want to have, like, that name recognition, and then yeah, you can throw in Ace Merrill, you can throw in Pot Merrill, like, throw these in, but they're so unmoored from what made them those characters. So mm-hmm, why do they have to be called that? Like you said, Jen, why does she have to be Annie Wilkes?
Right. Yeah.
That never.
Yeah. Story in Misery is one of my favorite parts of the book.
Yeah.
And the way that that unfolds through the memory book, like Memory Lane, I think I love that. And I'm not one to, like you were saying, like, I don't get all twisted in knots when they change the canon. But that part, like, I love that part. Mm-hmm. And to then, like, yeah, kind of pick it just to, like, be able to say the name Annie Wilkes and show an axe on your poster just feels cheap.
And well, it's bizarre too, because yeah, then later in the season, she has moments where she ties the guy to a bed,
mm-hmm,
and it's just, well, Joy ties her to a bed in one episode, and then later she ties a guy to a bed and holds a sledgehammer in her hand, and then has a butcher knife at yeah, one point, and just, and then we're supposed to be cheering for that.
It was
like,
all
we're
these,
like, oh
subversions,
yeah, she's
that
killing
are,
these bad guys
are so, like, tongue in cheek that you're like, well, you know how this goes, but we're gonna do the opposite, or, you know, we're gonna twist this around a little bit. And mm-hmm, it, honestly, I don't even know why I'm bringing this up, but it reminds me of, like, Star Wars The Last Jedi, where, like, they're like all the beats and things that you remember from Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, you know, Rian Johnson sitting there just being like, well, guess what? Well, it's not a snow planet. It's a salt planet. And they're actually not in the beginning fighting AT-STs, or it's going to be at the end. And,
but the, you know, difference and, like, there, Mike, is that in this world, we get her tying a guy to a bed and debating whether or not to, like, hit him with a sledgehammer or whatever. But she does do those things in the future.
Yes.
Because it is canon that she, like, because,
well,
they
yeah,
show the end with, like, it's canon in the sense
yeah,
that, okay,
she's
Paul
gonna go
Sheldon
on and do
is yet to come.
Yeah.
And that is going to happen because yeah, they hint at it. That means that all the things that reference the event of the future happen here, but they're heroically done when they're done here.
One of the things I started wondering with this is that, do you feel as if, because there's the connections to the first season are so loose
yeah,
at best. I mean, like, at one point you see, like, you know, Andre Holland's character, like, on a fucking, like, missing
yeah,
ad
in
Canada,
I mean, I thought that was
so dubious.
I thought and that was kind of in, that was
it
one,
was it was interesting, but it was also like, great, thanks
yeah,
at this point, the 25th
well, yeah,
hour.
If it's like, I don't know, if they, because I'll just say this, if it involved Bill Skarsgård, because
more,
spoiler alert, he returns.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and I want to talk about that.
I love him.
Yeah. Yes. So, the
but
only...
no, but here's my question about
okay,
this.
You go.
And it ties to this is, do you feel there was a point where they actually wanted to set this maybe in the 70s and or early on to actually still be, like, beholden to, like, the, you know, this the original, like, timeline.
Yeah, yeah.
Because none of it really needed to
but
be
But it wouldn't
set
have worked anyways because Ace wouldn't have been that age. Pop wouldn't have been that age. Like the timelines don't match up. And yeah. the history of Castle Rock, if you want to adhere at least somewhat to the books, none of it adds up time-wise.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
Throwing, mashing Annie and these characters in one story, it does not work.
What era does Sundog take place in?
It takes place right before Needful Things.
Yeah, so because obviously what ends with the burning.
Yeah,
down.
So it's like late 80s.
So it's late 80s. So like if they had set it in like 79, Misery,
I don't know,
and she's still young enough, because Misery is like, you know, 87, 86.
But even then, it's like the number one problem is that they're taking King IP,
mm-hmm.
and this is where everybody online is like telling me I'm crazy, but like they're taking King IP and they're not respecting it.
No.
And mm-hmm. maybe I sound like a fanboy. I don't really give a shit. Like it's like don't take a character who has a rich, interesting history,
yeah.
slap a name on somebody who has nothing to do with that character, and then Ace Merrill is such a great, interesting villain in the world of King, and then you kill Paul Sparks, who's playing him in the first episode, and then turn him into a zombie, and mm-hmm. he just talks in sort of a weird, disaffected tone the entire time. He is never Ace Merrill.
No.
He is never Ace Merrill. And then it's like, and then Pop Merrill too, it's like his story is also so disconnected from like what we do know about him. I have less issues with that story.
Mm-hmm.
But then Annie too, it's like they're trying to incorporate everything we know about Misery, which doesn't take place for another, you know, what, 20 years, like in at least in this timeline that they've built.
Yeah.
And they're trying to use everything we know about that to inform all of these early actions. And then they're giving her another backstory that is way too convenient for like,
well, all of it's convenient.
All of it. Yeah. It's like, and it just feels like what's the word? Fan fiction. Mm-hmm. Like it's Easter egg porn fan fiction, and it bugs me because it's like there are stories to tell here that are interesting, but it's like not when you call her Annie Wilkes.
Well, it kind of goes back to like our first season coverage for Castle Rock when I kept joking that Ruth was going to be Carrie.
Yeah.
and like the showrunners were just like, you know what? She is.
Oh,
like that sort of mentality. Like, I mean, it's just, it's so funny, and I don't know why I'm shocked that this actually happened, because given today's day and age, we were so lucky to actually even get a first season like Castle Rock where you can just do something organic and doesn't have to lean too hard on IP. But like in hindsight, of course they were going to go and lean more on the Jackie Torrance type
stuff. The American Horror Story route?
Yeah. I mean, because you know, like, it's just, like, why wouldn't they? I mean, the ratings weren't great on the first season. So how can you get it? Well, you got to show that this is as Stephen King as possible, you know, which you didn't, you know.
And I guess like if you were, okay, so I'm just, those were all my fundamental issues.
Yeah.
But then it just sucked.
I know.
It's like, it wasn't even good.
No.
And so, because basically,
on a narrative level, it's a disappointment.
Yeah. So the best episode, Jen, is there is one that goes back like 400 years.
Yeah.
And this is where it sort of evokes.
What?
Yeah.
It becomes like Jerusalem's Lot.
It becomes the Jerusalem's Lot short story from Night Shift, which is interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, mm-hmm. I'd say very loosely. There are connections, but it's very loose. And basically, there is a, you know, a very Christian settlement, and then one of them meets like a figure, like basically a hooded figure with like light emanating from under the hood, which is a very satanic image. And basically become Satanists, and there's this large group of Satanists, and then they basically,
because he's able to grow the crops and,
yeah,
you know.
Satan allows them to be able to Satan allows them to be able to grow the crops. So
does
they
he walk behind the rows?
What was that?
Does he walk behind the rows also?
No, well, probably.
I mean, it probably is Randall Flagg. Like,
well, that's what I want to talk about.
Yeah.
So basically we see that happen, and then they basically take over this village, and then they all like kill themselves to like come back in 400 years.
Yeah,
I'm missing a step
it's
somewhere.
So,
it's a little convoluted.
You're missing, it doesn't even matter if you miss steps, because the fucking show jumps like 30 steps also. But so like they basically do an inverse of, they lean on the what lore we know of, you know, the Marston house from Salem's Lot, and the idea that something
that
supernatural is there.
We see that the figure under the hood was Bill Skarsgård.
Yeah.
So, yes. And so, yeah, that was the most excited I was the entire season, because suddenly it felt like it was becoming a world again. Yeah. It felt like it felt like there was this nod to the first season, and it suddenly brought clarity to what the kid was.
Mm-hmm. Like, they even go back down to Shawshank.
Yes. Like, so and so we see them go into like where Henry Deaver locked up the kid at the end of the first season, and the cage is unlocked. Later we see a missing person sign for Henry Deaver. That's just an Easter egg, but it's there. And then and then we also see the kid
come to the town
as Satan.
Yeah.
Yeah. He walks through Athene. It's the implication of Athene. So we see that happen, this idea that he is traveling through time. They erect a statue of him in town, and everybody becomes hypnotized by it. But what I loved about the Bill Skarsgård cameo and the fact that he was that character was that it posited him as the Randall Flagg of this show's universe. Mm-hmm. This person who can travel through time, has affiliations with hell and whatever, you know, because we know that Randall Flagg like basically is an emissary of the devil and as it exists in King's World, and also, you know, travels through time and can manipulate people and basically make them his followers. And that to me is super interesting. And I was fascinated by that.
And they use a lot of the illusions that were in the penultimate episode of the first season.
Yeah.
You know, because like if you recall when they are running through the forest and, you know, you're going from the point of view of the kid and also where Henry Deaver has been as a child and all this time. There is that sequence where, you know, you see the person with like the butcher's knife and like in the forest, and that does come back and into here, and you find out why. And so there is some setup there. It just feels largely abandoned again in service for Annie Wilkes.
Yep. That's the thing is like all that interesting lore. And usually I'm not a big lore person.
I know.
But in this instance, I was enjoying it because it felt like it gave the whole thing a little weight. It didn't feel like these disconnected stories that were being mashed together. Yeah. I felt like I was in good hands for a minute.
And also, this is a show called Castle Rock.
Yeah.
And so, when it's about Castle Rock, kind of interesting.
Exactly. You know? And then, but then the last couple episodes just kind of became like an action movie a little bit. And there was a lot of explosions and they were blowing up the house. And it was
basically
like
what if we had a really cool night shift story that we're leaning on for episode 7. This is like our queen for season 2. But the next episode, we're going to do a Salt and Precinct 13 remake. And then after that, we're also going to just go into this like Gone Girl type thing where we're just going to focus on Annie. We're going to wrap up all these huge threads.
Oh, you mean like the epilogue?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Like we spend this entire time building up Pop, building up the nurse, building up, you know, his daughter, like all this other stuff. And they are just fucking ramshotted away, and you get Annie for 40 minutes with your daughter.
So the final episode ends with basically Annie and Joy leave town. They seem happy, but then Joy starts, because Joy's basically turned into like the demon child bride, like almost, and then they save her. And then, but there's the question of like, oh, is she still possessed? And then Annie becomes convinced that she is, and then kills her.
she
drowns her in the water. And I know. And then, but then it turns out that, but then there's like this whole fake dream sequence where she realizes what she's done and she saves Joy. But then, no, that's not the case. So basically it's like, oh, she's truly gone mad. And then that's when she's at the reading for Sheldon.
It's just such a weightless last episode that honestly, given how the first season ended and this one, it's like they don't know how to land it.
No.
You know, and granted, I don't think they ever really knew how to start the season. I think that, you know, like Jen, what you were saying with just watching the first two episodes, there is a lot. And I think that they had a little bit too much. Then maybe I still want to believe that they had just the Meryl storyline with the Somalians and all the stuff going on with Jerusalem's Lot. And then, you know, Hulu was like, where's the IP? And then
ultimately for me, the real story in all of it was the Meryl storyline and the Jerusalem Lot storyline. And the Annie stuff has interesting moments, but in the end, it's both shoehorned in and also the main focus, which is what's really hard about it. So I don't know. we tried, man. Like,
yeah.
But it's like, I think that it was frustrating. Mm-hmm. And that's, mm-hmm. I think, the big thing is we love the idea of this show. And the last thing we were so happy in the first season when it didn't turn into Stephen King Easter egg reference, yep. fan fiction, mm-hmm. porn. And then this second season, and there are, like, we bash on it, there are some good things. Like, it's, yeah. not a worthless watch. And it's loony and propulsive enough that, you know, if you're just half in, half out, you might kind of find some enjoyment in it. But for us, it's like we're just too connected to King, you know? We don't want the references, we want the characters. Yeah. We don't want the names, we want the actual history. Like, we want you to, like you did in the first season, like, use the world.
Yeah.
Don't just, like, point at the world. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Well, the way I always looked at it was like, all right, we're in an age where original storytelling is so hard to sell without having IP attached to it. Well, you had all the terrain and, you know, corollary characters that King has already created to go and tell your own original stories. And, like, I guess someone can make the argument that, yeah, this is an original story. It's like, yeah, sure, it's an original story.
But it is an original story.
But at the same time, it's also, you know, again, like, reworking or recalibrating already set stories. Like,
it's also not an inspired story.
No.
There's nothing all that exciting about
it. Like,
and it doesn't feel like a King story. Like, that's, if the first season at least felt like a King narrative, yeah. the second season doesn't.
No.
He did not write stories like this.
I don't even know what themes you'd even take away with
this. Right. Right. Like, the only thing, I don't know, if they do another season, I think it could potentially be, I mean, they point towards the Henry Deaver disappearance. They toy with Bill Skarsgård. If they do another season, they might be revisiting those characters. But then also, they're, because in the first season, they hint at the second season by showing a street sign for Jerusalem's Lot.
You did.
And that ended up being prescient in terms of what the second season was about. I think the penultimate episode of the second season, they show a street sign pointing to Derry. So if they do a third season, I think it could be set in Derry. What that means, who knows? Skarsgård playing multiple roles, maybe.
It's
playing
exactly.
Pennywise again.
I mean, because they all have basis in Warner Brothers, so it's like you could technically do it. But again, it's like, it's called fucking Castle Rock.
I know, right?
Just come up with some stories. Like, would it have been that hard for them to take the Fargo route and just come up with different stories in different eras and use the characters that are in those times?
Like, I know. And I think that's what's frustrating, too, is I can see the use of Ace and Pop because they're Castle Rock people.
Yeah.
Annie never has anything to do with that. She lives on the other side of the country. But it's like, you know, you're reading Needful Things right now.
Yeah.
How many characters?
Oh my God, there's so many.
That you could, like,
so many.
If you want to tell extended stories, there are so many people.
And it's hinted at that Bannerman has dealt with, you know, which is obviously before Pangborn, had so many things that he had to deal with that were outside of, like, you know, Cujo or the Dead Zone. It's like, yeah, make him a character.
Tell a Bannerman story.
Yeah.
I'm
going
to do it.
Have him early on.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's him just, like, fucking eating chili like he does in the Dead Zone. Like, I let's do something. Like, why do we need to have, you know, what's the next season going to be? Arnie from Christine's going to come back? Like, you know, like, characters that have nothing to do with it. Like, oh, look, oh, you know, a family moved into Derry and, you know, they're a doctor. And
it's the guy from Duma Key.
Yeah, it's a, exactly. Like, come on. I don't know. It just seems like such a waste. And I say all this and, you know, they're going to announce the third season. I'm going to have to write it up.
Yeah,
I'm gonna request screeners if they give them to me.
Well, if they give them to us,
they revoked mine.
They revoked yours, and they stopped. They didn't revoke mine, but they stopped giving me new ones.
Mm.
So when I was doing Easter egg duty on AV Club, and I would have to do it the day they dropped, which was very annoying. So you know. So there's that. But it's, I mean, third season drops. We're watching.
Where would you take it?
Where would I take it?
Yeah, how would you?
I mean, if I wanted, like, an ideal season, I would take, I mean, it's hard for me to, like, I wouldn't want to bring together a bunch of people from disparate King works.
No.
I would want to focus on somebody interesting from the Needful Thing, not Needful Things, but, like, Castle Rock lore. And, like, maybe tell us, like, an origin story for Frank Dodd, you know, like, from Dead Zone. Like, I mean, I know that sounds a little cheesy, but, like, a serial killer story about Frank Dodd and, like, becoming a serial killer. And I mean, obviously, you know how it ends because you know Dead Zone, but that's still more interesting to me than just like Mad Libs with Stephen King characters, yeah. You know, like at least give me, or like, you know, tell me what happened to, I'm trying to think of like some good examples, like give me a Norris Ridgwick story.
I know.
Give me an Andy Clutterbuck story. Like if these, or George Bannerman's a great example. Like give me just a procedural George Bannerman, like here's something he dealt with before Cujo, you know, like how far back do these things go? I don't know. I'm just riffing.
And you could even have a dumb Easter egg where he's like, oh, hey, Cujo. And he like pats on his head, even though he's going to rip his fucking guts out.
There you go. Yeah, Jen, what about you? Do you have any idea, like your ideal Castle Rock season?
My ideal Castle Rock season would be to stay in Castle Rock, just like what you guys were saying. I think a Buster season would be interesting because he's such a like a fulfilling villain. But if they're going to go Derry, I don't think they could stay away from going into it, but it would be cool to do more Insomnia kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Because I'm not a huge fan of that book, but I mean, that lends itself to batshit insanity, you know?
I would be into bring those little doctors back.
Yeah, maybe one of them's Bill Skarsgård, you know?
Cast them and everything.
I kind of hope they bring back Jerusalem's a little bit. We get some Ben Mears. He's not even Ben Mears from Salem's Lot, and you know he's married to Polly from Needful Thing. Let's just like fuck up the universe as much
just
as possible.
Tear it up, tear
and
it
like
to
you
pieces.
Know Ellie Creed is a teacher at the the school. It just make no sense. I don't want any of that. Cujo's a cat. Yeah, exactly. Oh God, there's like a car that that's not like that's for sale and it has to be Christine.
Oh my God. See, I mean, hey, go full camp and just throw it all in there.
Go
on, have Cooge driving Christine. Like we've made that joke, but it's
Tad Beaumont's like a Tad Beaumont, right?
I think so.
He's teaching like English, and he's just like he's got a brother that happens to be. Like corrupt that story also. Just stay away from Jackie Torrance. I don't want that.
Yeah, we don't want that. Let's just say, like, know that we are disappointed. You know, we wanted to like it. It's just it's like and know that we'll always enter into another season of Castle Rock with an open mind. Mm-hmm. We promise you that, listeners. But also watch The Outsider because we absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
And we're very excited for the year to come with King. We're going to be talking more about that next week. So stay tuned for that. What's that? Yeah.
A lot of TV this year.
And there's probably, I guarantee that more stuff's going to be announced and probably some stuff's going to drop that we're not even, aware that's going to happen.
I know.
So,
I mean, for all we know, like, Thomas Jane's new movie that he's doing. Buick 8 from Buick 8? Is he doing?
Yeah, he's doing Buick 8.
You know, watch that drop by the end of the year.
Yeah, yeah. Tom Jane it's like his production company, too. Yeah. So
he's playing the Buick.
And we're big Tom Jane fans here at Losers Club. So
love Tom Jane. So.
I just want my kids back, man.
Yes, exactly. Oh, God.
Sweet.
So Jen, what do you have coming up for Horror Virgin?
So we just I think the episode that recently dropped was Final Destination, and we just recorded our listener request, which was Train to Busan.
Ooh.
And none of us had seen it before, and spoiler, we all loved it, and it was it was kind of an emotional watch if you've seen that movie, but it was really fun. And then next we are going to do Women in Horror Month for February. So we've picked some good, strong female characters. And we're going to start off with Silence of the Lambs, which I'm really
nice to get us primed for Clarice, the show.
I feel like I know many people who say their favorite horror movie is Silence of the Lambs.
Mm. Well, we were talking to Todd. He watched the trailer for it, and he was like, wait, so he's in jail, and then he gets out, and the movie is about them finding him, right? And we were both looking at him like, oh, my God, he doesn't know what's going to happen. I'm so excited to watch
what a
it with
gift.
Him.
Yeah, it's so much more macabre than that. Buffalo Bill is just...
No, that's such a gift, though, to be able to watch, like, I don't know, something like that with somebody who has no idea what's coming.
Yeah.
That's the best,
Especially with a movie like that, that I feel like is so known.
Yeah, everybody knows what happens in Silence of the Lambs. Yeah. So when you find somebody who doesn't, it's like, watch it quick before it gets spoiled.
I know, don't tell him anything.
That's amazing.
It's funny because it's very rare that I don't know what I'm going to be seeing going into it, but the only one I could think of where I legit did not know was From Dusk Till Dawn.
Oh, nice.
Because I hadn't really heard anything about it. And I just caught it late at night. And when the vampires happened in that, I was like, what the fuck am I watching?
Mine was Sleepaway Camp.
Oh, the ending
that?
That
never
yeah.
got spoiled for me.
That wasn't spoiled either, yeah. That's.
I watched it on a date, like, like 7 or 8 years ago. I know, it was like, well, that was kind of what I liked about it was, I was like, okay, this girl's cool.
Starter.
Like, well, we were talking about horror all night, yeah. And then she's like, hey, come back, we'll watch Sleepaway Camp, because I was like, I've never seen Sleepaway Camp. And then I had no idea what happened, and I remember, like, I found it genuinely really, really scary.
Yeah.
Like, really scary.
Well, that ending shot where
the movie's
frames.
Really cheesy and silly and not great.
Yeah.
And then that final, like, 2 minutes mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. is enough to justify that film's, like, you know, enduring legacy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's
I agree.
So
yeah.
scary.
I agree.
Well, thank you so much, Jen. This was a blast. It was fun to talk about The Outsider. Hopefully we'll have you on again. Hopefully.
Yeah, I'd love to.
Sweet. Well, Mike, I think it's time to sign off. First episode of 2020. Good times.
This was a good time.
Do you have anything else to add before we sign off?
No, I just know that we have some long days.
And pleasant nights. Thanks, everyone.
I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends. I got some hot friends. God, I got some hot friends.
Consequence Podcast Network.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM Podcast Network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.